discussion and presentation. And I wanted to give you some food for thought at the very beginning. I apologize to those people who were in my session earlier today because you've already seen this chart. But I think as a basic idea of what mobility as a service is, let's take a look at this chart for a minute and look at the various components of it. At the center are the people traveling or attempting to travel. And around that circle, we have various forms of transportation that people can avail themselves of, public transport, some kind of other mobility services. They could use aviation or maritime, or they could be looking at package delivery and logistics. The really important part of mobility as a service is that you are giving travelers all the possible options to go from point A to point B and allowing them to pay for it just once, because your trip might involve multiple providers of transportation services. So one part of mobility as a service, and one of the definitions that we talk about, is that it can be just one payment for all the services you're going to utilize. So if you look on the left-hand side, you see in the upper left-hand corner some bike sharing, car sharing. That could be part of your transportation solution from point A to point B. On the right-hand side, you see there's some on-demand transportation. And then if you look in the lower left-hand corner under the facilitators, data is a big discussion. I'm going to come back to that in just a minute. Payment is, I already talked about. And then on the lower right-hand corner, the enablers of mobility as a service is really providing real-time information to the customer as they're traveling from point A to point B. So if we, I usually incorporate this in my presentations, not so much for this audience, but I think mobility as a service, people throw the term around and don't really know exactly what it means. And we have some rather antiquated terms in the US that people are also associating to mobility as a service, but it's not really that. So mobility as a service is really providing an integrated package of mobility services that you pay for, whether you pay for it when you make your trip plan or itinerary, or you could pay on a monthly subscription basis. Those are both sort of important facets of mobility as a service. But when you look at some of these other terms, they're not mobility as a service, but people are using them that way. So if we look, let's go right to the bottom, because Jenny mentioned this before. Mobility on demand and mobility as a service are not the same things. Mobility as a service is one potential solution in the toolbox that mobility on demand has. But mobility on demand is really, you have immediate access to transportation through a variety of different tools. Mobility as a service is one of them. And then in this transportation camp, we're also talking quite a bit about mobility management. And that is, as most of the folks in this room know, is a bit different than mobility as a service, but I think mobility as a service could potentially facilitate mobility management in the way we usually envision it. And then the only other one I'm going to mention is transportation demand management. That term has also been around for more than 30 some odd years. And really there, it's the deployment of strategies in order to incentivize people to travel, I would say, more smartly in terms of getting out of single occupant vehicle. And this has really been, TDM has been huge, particularly in California. So these are all still valid terms, but they don't mean mobility as a service. And then by way of introduction to what Jenny is going to talk about, I thought it would be worthwhile to look at a framework that I want you to think about whether this may or may not work for your vision of mobility as a service. We've got in the upper right-hand corner some needs within the policy part of mobility as a service. And this particular example, by the way, is from a small urban and suburban area. So it may or may not fit with our definition that Jenny's gonna talk about of rural mobility as a service. In the upper left-hand corner, we do have some technology needs, but we also need to consider the equity piece, which I did talk about this morning. Not everyone's gonna have a smartphone, not everyone's gonna have a data plan on a smartphone, not everyone is gonna be able to pay with a credit card. We need to keep that in mind as well as the technology needs. In the lower left-hand corner, we're talking about infrastructure. And why are we talking about that? Because mobility as a service only operates when you have partnerships among the various types of mobility services, which are potentially provided by a number of different entities. So we need to think about that. We need to think about incentives to get people to utilize something like mobility as a service, so you see their customer loyalty. So we have some infrastructure needs. And then on the lower right-hand side, we have some data needs. And they're pretty significant data needs. Not only the real-time information, but we need to be collecting data about people's travel behavior. This is one of my, when I get on my soapbox, one of the things that I talk about a lot is we make a lot of assumptions about how people's travel behavior changes in the face of tools like mobility as a service, but frankly, we don't really know yet. So we need to be collecting data that speaks to us better understanding travel behavior. But mobility as a service also can't operate without data sharing from the providers of the services to the mobility as a service provider. So there are a number of different ways to look at data. And with that, I am going to hand it over to Jenny.
Thank you, Carol. Really interesting. I find that quite spooky because that last slide, the source of that is from IBI Group, and IBI are really quite a large entity in Scotland. Can you guys hear me or not?
Yes,
we can. Yes, we can. Cool. So I find that quite spooky, Carol, that you're using an IBI Group template when it's coming back to haunt me from Scotland. Anyway, nice to meet you. I have to say it's 1 o'clock time here. It's half past, well, nearly half past six our time. So it's definitely time to get on with talking about rural mass. For those of you that are in the room, who would classify themselves as living in a rural area? Hands up. Okay, keep it up. Keep your hand up. Have you got a car at home? If you have, keep your hand up. How many cars do you have at home? One, two, or three? One. Two? Two? Do you think living in a rural area that you could give up your cars? Yes? No?
No, everybody's shaking their head no.
Right, okay. So, In Europe, a lot of people talk about mass as being something, a way of only using public transport. it's not about having a car. Whereas I emphasize quite regularly that actually for rural mass to happen, you do need to still have ownership of a car. Carol and Dwight can intervene whenever they want, but what you've got up on the slide at the moment is Finland. Everybody also says that Finland is the place, the birthplace of mass. Dwight would probably disagree given his startings back in 2010. But Finland are very urban centric when it comes to mass, but they do have five projects, and these are the ones on the screen just now. Five projects which will be of interest to you. If you want them, Dwight can give you the links and this PDF. But the first one is about, it's all European funded, by the way. And VTT is very well connected with Tampere University. So they're actually running in December a conference on international mass, of which one main theme is rural. So if you want to know more about it, just shout and I can give you the information. But that first slide is a very generic mass project that happened for about 18 months. And they explored what mass meant to business models, and they wanted to try and develop a roadmap. I don't know what, if one of my assistants can press the button for the next slide. Can somebody press the button for the next slide?
Yes, of course. Yeah.
Okay.
We got it.
So this slide here, they've called it rural mass, and if you go and Google it, you will find heaps of information about what they're doing, but it is all about the concept rather than reality. So they've done an analysis of what business models exist, and they've also looked at existing literature, but they haven't actually gone to speak to anybody yet, which is Carol and I's passion, about what they think rural mass should be and what it should look like. The diagram that you have there, I'll come back to in a minute, but this project has now completed, and they did actually come up with a definition of rural mass. 9 times out of 10, as Carol will say, all the definitions relate to urban areas. This is the only project I've ever seen that has a rural mass definition. So if we move on to the next project that they're doing. Next slide. This one will hit the heart of many of you in the room because it's looking at the health and social services side of things. Now, for me, mass is not just about the person on the public transport and being able to get the one ticket. It's about utilising your assets correctly and efficiently in rural areas. So, as many of you know, health and social services are very stretched resource-wise and budget-wise, and it's probably the same in the US. So, to be able to integrate it into one solution, this is what they're looking at. And they're going to implement a digital platform, but again, in usual fashion, it's siloed. They're looking at it as health and social services as one. To me, when you're looking at a mass project in rural areas, it should encompass education, health, social services, and your public transport. Next slide, please. This one is quite interesting. It's more of a business mass. Quite often you hear people talk about mass and then there's business mass. This is going down that section, looking at how SMEs are operating in rural areas and what they need to do to digitalise and to help make legislative changes. In Finland, and I could talk about this for hours, they have a very different infrastructure system and legal framework. So 2 years ago, they changed things, so there's a lot more open data, collaboration can take place, commercialisation isn't such an issue. So these projects can happen. If you took this project and took it into the UK or other places in Europe, that infrastructure set up and legal framework isn't there, so it wouldn't work. So it's a really interesting one and worth going to check out. Next slide. You might need to get your atlas out for this one, but this is involving Lapland and tourism. Where I'm sitting from at the moment in Scotland is in the Highlands of Scotland, and if I could turn the laptop round to show you some mountains, I would, but it's full of fog. I'm sitting in a ski resort, and this is very much what's behind this project, is skis, ski buses, tourism, and connecting up remote travel destinations. So again, it's still at fairly early stages, but they haven't done a huge amount of user engagement, which I think when you're traveling with such skis, snowboards, you need to think about that in the whole solution process. Next slide, please. So this is the last one. This is what colleague Jenny at VTT came up with in that first slide I showed you. This is their model for business, for rural mass. Now, it's called the four P's. So you've got people, which is really important, as Carol said. You've got participation, you've got public sector, and you've got the private sector. Now, I'm not 100% comfortable yet with this diagram that they've generated, because this wasn't based on any user interfacing that they did. This was all theoretical, and Carol, would you not agree it would look slightly different if it had the user-centered approach to it?
I totally agree with you. It would look completely different.
Yeah. So the slides I don't have for you is to tell you what's happening in Scotland. Now, in Scotland, we have been looking at mass since about 2014. Back then, it was called Mobility Challenge. We're now in a situation where the government, the Scottish government, not the UK government, the Scottish government has provided a fund, an investment fund for £2 million. And they are looking for projects to come forward. And one of their key themes is rural. They've got rural islands and communities, and then the other element is tourism, and then the other element is accessibility. For my sins, I sit on the working group for the Scottish Government on this to try and help shape how we go forward. But we're looking for communities to get involved and really take on this collaborative approach, whether it's to help solve problems in the rural islands or the rural economy. Personally, I took on a part-time PhD on top of my work commitments about a year ago. I think that's how Dwight found me. I think somebody from his office found me on LinkedIn or something. Was that not how it happened?
Yes, and it was an article also.
And then Carol I met in London in November, so that's how you're ending up with a Scottish voice in your room. I got funding from two bodies to do 3 months' work in understanding user needs, which is what Carol was talking about earlier on, and what are the barriers and what are the opportunities to rural mass. And this does require a bit of a revisit back to the traditional rural transport elements, but I've taken a very collaborative approach, and we've had everybody sitting there from health and social services all the way through to your train providers, bus providers, community transport, car sharing. So we've done a lot of workshops, we've done interviews, we've done surveys. One's in the Highlands where I'm sitting, and the other one is on the east coast of Scotland, if anybody knows it, in Aberdeen, or just outside Aberdeen. So we're getting two different dynamics of what people classify as accessible rural. And what I've said back to the Scottish Government is, for mass to work, you need several things. One of them is open data and the ability to do collaboration. And the other one, from rural point of view, is simply to have the available infrastructure. So in Scotland, it's probably a bit like you guys. Quite often you can get on a bus and the bus arrives at the train station just as the train has left. Now, if you want to be able to do integrated mass of people, goods and services, we need to really look heavily at how we can help resolve those issues to be able to roll out some of this £2 million. So we've had a project as well called Navigogo, which, if you look that one up, it was based Dundee direction and was urban and rural and looked at how young people travelled around. So there's quite a bit going on in Scotland. We've also got an organisation called Mass Scotland, which is a membership base and is the largest one in Europe. I think we're over 75 members of different academia, businesses, small and large, and local authorities. So there's a lot going on in Scotland, and I think the appetite is now appealing for discussions on rural mass, because urban mass, in my viewpoint, is a lot easier to do because you have a lot more choices. Whereas in rural areas, we have a huge development to make in technology, but we can also bring a huge amount to the local economy. So I will pass back to Carol, who will probably agree or disagree with what I'm saying, because we're a bit of a yin and yang, aren't we?
Point, counterpoint. Is anyone old enough to remember that from Saturday Night Live?
Well, thanks, Jenny. There were a couple things that I just want to bring up quick. One is, I understand why people would think that it would be easier for it to occur in a large urban area or in a metro area. I also can realize that it can be extremely difficult to occur there, not because of the lack of transportation per se, but because of the political environment and economic competition and the general ruthlessness that is very bare bones when you go to a major metro area. And you don't necessarily have that when you're outside, and in small urban rural, it's a different environment. A lot of people generally want to help each other because you never know when you need help. And there's much more of an interest in collaboration. So I just want to pass that back to you.
It's interesting. Having done the two projects in Scotland, I would say it depends very much on the communities that you are working with. So where I'm sitting at the moment in the Highlands, there is that, I want to work with you, I know my next door neighbour, I will help you out, I'll get you to the train station. In Aberdeenshire, it's more commuter village. Nobody knows their neighbours. So although it's classified as rural, they get up at 6 o'clock in the morning, they go to work, they come back again. So I think it's very difficult to classify rural under one umbrella. I think Scotland's got 35 definitions or something silly about what rural is. So it's going to depend on where you are and who you are, and what you want to do and where you want to go. But my personal experience when I go to the cities is that it's a lot easier to find something as an alternative means of transport because you have the choice. Whereas in rural areas, we just don't have the choice. Carol?
Yeah, I think going back to your point about having all the definitions about rural, I think we suffer from the same thing here. But what's even worse is in terms of land area of the United States, it's mostly rural, but that's not what gets the money, that's not what gets the press, it's the urban focus. And I think your point about having a different definition, I think, is really, really important, because the goal of putting mobility as a service in place, in my humble opinion, is completely different than the goal of putting mobility as a service in place in an urban area. We're always hearing in the urban areas, we want to reduce car ownership. We want people to stop driving, you know, single occupant vehicles into the city. And the cities that we're talking about are typically European or Scandinavian, which means that they're even more dense than some of our cities. And the public transport infrastructure is much more significant. And when we start talking about rural, the goal is not to reduce car ownership. And you stated it very well at the beginning that in order to make it work, you do need to have automobiles.
Yeah.
So I think making that distinction in terms of what the goals are is something we need to keep beating on people so that they don't have the one view. You know, I kind of purposely showed that slide from Finland, the first slide that I had up in the presentation, because it does kind of describe the parts of mobility as a service that you need, but it doesn't speak to the overall goal. And so I think that's the important part. And also this slide that's still up on the screen, I think you're right. When you start asking real people what they really need, this is going to look a lot different.
I mean, some people, from my perspective here, when you're looking at hidden disabilities, they may have arthritis, but they can't actually physically get on the bus because the bus is the wrong design. They don't know that the low-floor bus is arriving on a particular day. It might be a coach. So that inability to access and use transportation may not seem obvious to a bus operator, but it's something like that that has to be considered when you're shaping what the user actually needs out of services. Now, what I didn't mention is the role, and I know there's been some chat about this already, about prescriptions and goods, because for me, as Carol knows, in the rural area, we need to be considering that, because personally, I have to go the equivalent of about 20 to 25 kilometers to go and pick up a prescription. How is that model right? I don't think it is. Could I be doing something more with my car? Could I be car sharing? Could I be picking up goods and extra goods and services? Now, I know Dwight's got his program that he runs, but that's something that's not even been considered, that model, yet in the UK. But we need to think about why people are making those trips. And it's very easy for me to say to people, well, the Scottish Government, you need to do something about this. And they'll go, but why? Where's the evidence? So that's what I've been trying to do, is gather this evidence to say, well, actually, we need to rethink what we're doing at the moment. And we can reallocate resources. And we can target money in a better way. Instead of talking about taking money away, let's target the resources in the correct way. And let's see a vehicle being utilised as much as it possibly can. So there's a bus which just went past me just now with one person on it, but it's a 30-seater. Why are we letting that happen? Because we're subsidising it.
Yep.
We need to understand these user needs to be able to shape mass going forward.
So Jenny, I have a couple of questions for you. One is, do you have volunteer transportation services in Scotland? I mean, here in our audience, we have the largest volunteer transportation service in the state of New York, covering three counties, which is the size of one of our neighboring states. Five counties. So it's like really big.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Do you have where drivers volunteer essentially their time to drive, and most of the time?
We do, but probably not to the same element as you have, and the demographic is probably, I'm going to hazard a guess here, slightly different. So if anybody wants to look at it, look up Community Transport Association, and there's also a branch in Scotland, the CTA. We have a number of community transport organisations, is what we call them here. They are run, they've got paid people in the office, so you might have four or five members of staff, but it is all run by volunteers. The problem we've got in the rural areas is that they're very full, because it's the elderly that are utilising it, or it's people with various difficulties or disabilities. And nine times out of ten, the drivers are retired personnel, which means you can only operate it, because they don't, in the winter, just to give you an idea here, in the winter, it doesn't get daylight till after about 9 o'clock in the morning, and it can be dark again at 3 o'clock. A person of a certain age does not like driving in the dark, so it is only operational in the winter during those hours, which is pretty restrictive. We do not have a young demographic willing to participate in this. We haven't got that volunteer culture. They are all stretched, and they are all, how do I describe it, receiving very little subsidy from the government, whether that's the UK or the Scottish government. And we also have a legislative issue as well to do with the type of driving licence and licence that they need to have. And it's a bit of a problem at the moment, because the Department for Transport is trying to put regulations in place that will really restrict community transport. So yes, we do, in the answer to your question, but it tends to be in rural areas there to fill the gap on services that just aren't being delivered or have been cut. Mm. Is that the same with you guys?
I think for most of New York State, that's a very fair representation. But I think one of the roles of what the mobility managers are doing is how can we in a way more professionalize the recruitment of drivers, and just getting things more organized than when these services were set up, many of them back in like the 1970s or the 1980s, but bring things more forward.
So the one locally to me here, I won't even get you to try and spell it because you probably can't, but it's Bakenhof and Strathbay Community Transport. They have over 3,000 registered users, but they only have 120 drivers available to them. And that's not necessarily available to them each day. So, and they only have 4 minibuses.
Wow. I think we have 28. So I want to open up questions, comments that people have from the audience. Gary?
Am I better off coming up? Can you hear me, Jenny?
Just and no more. Go for it.
All right. Yeah, bring it back that way. So, not that I'm discounting people in mass, but we just came to a realization we have a campus-to-campus service. So we have our Ithaca, New York campus, we have a Geneva campus, and we have two campuses that live in New York City. And we have our own buses that run from Ithaca to New York, and a lot of research being done at Weill Cornell. And we were having separate delivery services, delivering, you know, specimen, whatever that might be, to Weill over in New York City. So I think and I'll bring this to two points, having that multiple thing where you're delivering people and you're also being able to deliver a certain product, whatever it might be, there's that. And then the weird thing that happened to me just 3 days ago, I'm an anti-Walmart person, so that's just me, just whatever. So I was mad at my wife. I said, what the heck did you buy Walmart? We had a Walmart delivery thing on my doorstep. So of course, you know, it's really bad to assume things. And she goes, no, I just did subscribe and save for, you know, XYZ. And here, Walmart and Amazon are already looking at that open data. So she ordered an Amazon set of products that were delivered by Walmart, which I found fascinating.
I've heard of one case whereby somebody was looking on Amazon at some books and they didn't purchase those books because they just decided that they weren't for them. But they arrived in the post the following day and they contacted Amazon and said, why have I got these books? Because I didn't actually order them. And they said, no, you didn't, but you spent a lot of time looking at them, so we thought they'd be of interest to you. They're yours for free. So Amazon started to take this behavioral patterns and started to use it as a marketing tool. And I think there's a lot of lessons that we can actually learn from that in transport.
Yeah.
Because we're all about travel behavior change, but actually we need to understand that behavior. So if your wife went and did that click and collect or save or whatever it is, that technology and algorithms can be introduced into mass.
But it's quick theory. She actually purchased on Amazon. Made the purchase, which is the weird thing that all of a sudden it was delivered by Walmart. So that, I think that's a neat thing that even these competitors who are neck and neck at each other are, so that way we're not creating more CO2.
There's also this collaboration word. I think a lot of people take it for granted that it's easy to do, but it's not. Businesses and local authorities and communities are all starting to work together because they can see so many benefits. So I'm not surprised Amazon's working with Walmart on this, because there'll be things Amazon can provide that Walmart can't. To go back to your first question, which has now escaped me, to do with the universities. Interestingly enough, St Andrews in Scotland has just started looking at what they can do with the minibuses that they are running around. And I quite rightly said to them, if you need to be taking soil samples from one place to another, why are you not bloody using the same vehicle? There have been issues, and you'll get this as well, to do with security. Apparently, since the whole 9/11 issue, people are more wary of it, whereas we used to have in Scotland the post bus, where the postman used to deliver not only your mail, but your sausages and your milk and all the rest of it. So I think we're going back full circle onto that, but we have a bigger issue to do with security that we didn't used to have.
Okay, great. Dawn from Way to Go, Cornell Cooperative Extension.
Hi, Jenny. Can you hear me?
I can hear you, but I can't see you because Dwight's just blocked my camera.
I'm sorry.
I can see you.
So I'm for the first time really thinking about this idea of urban versus rural mass, which is really helpful. And then you were very pointed about saying we're not asking people to give up their cars. You know, we live here in Ithaca. It's a small urban surrounded by a lot of rural. And it would be silly to think about asking all, you know, the people who live in rural areas to give up their cars. Because even if they end up commuting in some way with others. The car gets them to places that any kind of transport won't. But I'm wondering if we could hear a little bit more about your vision for rural MAAS, because there is still that component of using a variety of services. So it's obviously not even nuanced, but it's a different idea than urban. So can you give us a little bit of a picture, even just maybe some scenarios that you're thinking of to help us?
So my ideal vision is that the person living in a rural area has a choice, because at the moment there isn't a choice. Personally, my car can sit on my driveway for 3-4 days. I say driveway, farm track, because I am either working from home or I am getting on a train and traveling by train. So I have an asset that's sitting there that could be of use to a rural community. Could I better use my car? Could I give it to somebody that can't afford to run a car? Could I car share it? The scenarios for me I'm looking at the moment are young people. In rural areas in Scotland, young people are leaving in droves. So to give you an idea, the Cairngorm National Park, which is where I'm sitting, is about the same size as Luxembourg, but they have 500,000 population. We have 18,000 people in this area, and we have over 2 million visitors. But we can't keep young people in the area because it's expensive to live. It takes 2.5 hours to get a bus to go to university one way. And once they leave, we can't get them back. So for me, the vision is, how can we use MAAS as a tool to help young people have the choice, if that's what they want, to stay in the area, to go to education, or to get a job. I'm also really wanting to make sure that, not the elderly, but more the aging demographic, from those people that are 50 plus, have the choice as well. Because people, particularly my neighbours in this area, have all had health problems. And it can be one form or another that you're not expecting, and then you're without a car. You lose your license because you've had a seizure. You're not able to drive because you've had surgery. That then makes people feel really isolated. And I would like to think that we can develop rural MAAS so that we don't feel isolated in areas. But young people is a really big issue. And interestingly enough, when we've done the engagement, I've had the young people from interviews. I could have interviewed hundreds of young people, but when you do an online survey, they're not interested. Under the age of 26, I only got a 10% response rate from the under 26. So why is that? Is that because young people don't see transport as a problem, or is it it's just they're not interested in it, or is it the wrong way to go and actually ask their opinions? So there's a lot going there. I think the speed, and Carol will probably tell me she agrees with this, I would say the speed of which MAAS in itself has developed in the last 18 months has been phenomenal. It has taken us at least 45 minutes for me to say the word app, whereas previously any single mention of MAAS would have had the word app in the definition. We're not talking about that anymore. Well, I'm not, Carol hasn't, nobody's said anything about apps so far. So the conversation's going. I know from my academic perspective, when I started it a year ago, there were 6 journal articles globally with the words rural MAAS in them. That is, it's over 60 now. So it's really developing, but it's still a concept. Nobody actually has MAAS operating in the developed world as we all think. It's just people talking about it, like I am, like Carol has, like we all do. But we're working towards that vision, and it's how you get there, I think. It's going to be unique. Yours is going to be different from the way that we're going to do it. Does that help?
Yeah, thank you.
Yep. Any other question? I have a follow-up question for you, Jenny. You talked about open data.
Yeah.
And you talked about in Finland, I think it was in their legislation that was passed a year ago or so, discussed open data or required open data. Could you just define a little bit more, help us get our heads wrapped around open data? And I guess the question that we would have here is, how a government can require open data among private entities would be seemingly almost a non-starter unless you buy the access.
So to pick up on Carol's example earlier, if you're doing real-time passenger information for buses, it is very siloed, and the feeds that you need for that to go into the displays or your app are usually owned either by the local authority or council or the business. What the open data is pushing is that those feeds are available to anybody at any point in time. And if it's real-time information, whether it's a train, plane, or automobile, it absolutely doesn't matter. The same goes for accessibility to data for car sharing, for bike hire. If you want to digitalize anything, you need to be able to release it to the public. Now, obviously, you will have the same as us where you've got these open data platforms where some of that already exists. In Scotland, we have a transport bill that is just in front of Parliament at the moment, and one of the key elements to it will be for transport operators that they must make their feeds, for want of a better description, available. If you look at WIM that was operating in West Midlands, it had very few modes incorporated into it. You can go and look at something called Travelline in the UK, and there's one in England and one in Scotland. And that's meant to take all the live data feeds together to produce this platform. Some would argue that it is a mass platform. I personally wouldn't, because it's not very reliable and it doesn't provide a holistic journey from A to B if you needed to go via the doctors on the way to something. So in Finland, what they did is deregulated it, opened it up, allowed competition to happen, but within a sensible framework. So that you weren't, if you're an RTI guy, a bus operator, you weren't feeling that your commercialities were infringed. You still had that proprietary agreement, but you had to share the information. It's going to be a hard slog. It is a key barrier because it means you need government buy-in to realise that for the end user to benefit, there needs to be a breakdown in some of the commercial barriers or perceived commercial barriers that we've had. Does that make sense?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, I wanted to add something to that, Jenny, because very recently in Washington, D.C., there was some legislation put forward to require the ride sourcing companies, which some people call transportation network companies here in the U.S., Uber, Lyft, Via. And the legislation was a requirement that they share their data.
Yeah.
In just like what we're talking about here, the legislation was shot down, which didn't surprise me at all, because the lobbying by those companies is pretty significant. Yeah. But what has happened in the US, and this is not rural areas necessarily, because I think it could be even harder there because there may be more entities, like when we're talking about package delivery, in addition to passenger delivery. In Dallas, Texas, they are building their mobility as a service platform, and they have partnerships with Uber and Lyft. However, Uber and Lyft both refuse to be on the same platform as their competitor. So in order for Dallas to come out with this application, they had to select one. So I don't remember who they selected, doesn't really matter. But what it does matter is the effect on the customer. The customer doesn't have the other information about the other provider. The whole idea is for the customer to have all the information. So I think it's a very, very critical question. And I don't know, particularly in the States, how it could possibly be legislated. But I know there are a number of other areas that are trying to do the same thing. like in the area that I live, in the Boston area, they're trying to somehow make the ride sourcing companies provide their data, but each company doesn't want it side by side.
I think it's going to come down to the way things are procured. I don't know, Carol, if you were in the room 18 months ago when I was doing the London intelligent transport session, but a gentleman from a council in England put his hand up and said, how do I get mass? And the people sitting on the panel, who I will not name, all said, come and see me, because they were business commercialities, come and see me and we'll sell you an app. So you're going to have to guess who the three or four panelists were.
I know them. I was there. I know exactly right. Who you're talking
about. I then went on to chair a session after lunch, and I said, look, can we go back to this question of how do you get mass? I said, Steve, it's not to me about going to buy an app or a digital platform, but you've got contracts there for parking, for urban transport management systems, for traffic lights, for buses, for taxis. You've got all the players and stakeholders around the table because you're engaged with them already with contracts. When those contracts come up for renewal, that's when you can start playing hardball. And if you want open data, you explicitly put it in. And if somebody wants to bid for it, then that's the headline that they're going to have to work with. And interestingly enough, if you want to look up Milton Keynes, Steve, since then, I saw him just 2 weeks ago, has developed a huge amount of things and has changed the way he's doing his contracts. So I do think it's going to be a case of how people have relationships with each other. And I don't mean that in a dodgy sense, but I mean that on a council, local authority working with a business person, but also the other way around. What do I want out of it? What can I get out of it? And how can we actually procure this?
Yeah, I think the procurement issue is critical because you and I probably both read the same paper from, I can't remember the name of the city in West Sweden that was, quote, procuring mobility as a service. Mm-hmm. And it was a dismal failure because at the pre-proposal meeting, all of the smart people and everybody in the room was really smart about mobility as a service. But nobody really thought about how do we get this? How do we procure it? And they ended up canceling the procurement because there were more questions raised than the city could answer. And
but I think that's the nature of mass, though. It's making you look at more than just one mode of transport and how people get around. So I think it's mind-blowing, to be honest, particularly when you come to procure something.
Okay, I think we have time for one more question or statement or words of encouragement.
Or maybe one for Carol so everybody doesn't keep hearing my voice.
They don't want to hear mine either, trust me.
So,
I have a question.
What? Yes, please.
Can you hear me?
I can just hear you, yeah.
Okay, how is the train, like one of the things that intrigues me is how we sort of got, not completely, but we sort of done away with a lot of trains, you know, commuting, and in the U.S. And I was just wondering how it is in Scotland.
So in the UK, we have a very interesting situation with the trains. It's very privatized, but the actual rail line, the actual infrastructure is owned by the government, by Network Rail. And then they franchise out all the rail networks. So in Scotland, we've got Abellio running our services, which is called ScotRail. At the moment, many people are not happy because we're meant to be having new trains put on and they've not delivered them. Train use is increasing. Patronage is going up, despite the fact that ticket prices are going up. Train use is going up, particularly in the business sector, because they've seen the value for being able to do work on the train rather than by sitting in a car. The problem we have in Scotland is that in the 60s, 70s, as you probably well know, a lot of our rail got ripped out the ground. So we don't have the same infrastructure that we used to have. But it is delivering a service, it's delivering tourism. It's growing. It's one of the few. The bus is diminishing, and the patronage is down seriously on buses, but patronage on rail is up.
Excellent. So, Jenny, as we're getting ready to to thank you very much for participating with us. I think this is the first transportation camp ever that had a, well, came at least a person from Scotland participating, so we got that feather. Could you retell the story about the Sunday, or was it Saturday afternoon, problems with running trains because of the crew?
Oh yeah. So the problem we've got with trains at the moment is that they haven't, because they're changing the type of train, they haven't actually got enough drivers that are qualified to run the new trains. So at the moment we have a situation whereby trains are just not turning up because we haven't got enough people. And that means on a Sunday we have a particularly big problem, because drivers are not contracted to drive on a Sunday. They have to volunteer to drive on a Sunday, which means our whole Sunday service is in limbo, depending who wants to work. And that has big implications, because if you work the Sunday, you then obviously have to have other days off due to working time directives. So at the moment, our rail industry is struggling because we don't have enough people, and we have a contract that says you don't need to work a Sunday.
And what was And what was one of the prime reasons why they were not available on Sunday in the afternoon?
Well, you can imagine. What would you be your guess? It's not football related, is it?
Well, very good. First, we want to thank you very, very much for joining us, and you deserve a big hand. So.
Dwight, the one thing I would say, I forgot to mention, if anybody's really interested in maths, go and look at New Zealand. This is my final thought for you. New Zealand have a lot going on in Christchurch and Auckland, and as a government, to me, they are leading the way in how maths can be delivered, because they're looking at it in a holistic way from the ground up. But they are going into rural areas. They've developed various business cases that can be used, and I can circulate them, or you can contact them directly at the New Zealand authorities. But my vision, going back to that earlier question, is that they've taken intelligent transport systems, so smart roads, UTMCs, the whole lot, and they see that as very much part of how mass can be delivered. It's not just mass on its own. So for me, to answer that question earlier on, if we can keep up with New Zealand, or even catch New Zealand, or do what New Zealand are doing, we're on to a winner.
Great. Well, thank you again.
And no, I'm going to have a glass of wine now, because it's nearly 7 o'clock my time.
It is definitely time for wine.
Yeah.
So thank you again.
I will love you and leave you. I will hang up. I hope you all enjoy the rest of your day. And I'm sure Dwight can give you my email if anybody's got any questions.
Okay. Thank you again.
Thanks,
Jen.
Okay. Yeah. See you
bye-bye.
Later, Carol.
Bye.
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 One last thing before everybody runs out of the room. Ironically, one of Jenny and my colleagues, who happens to also be in Scotland, just wrote this lengthy LinkedIn post about how terrible ScotRail has been and how mobility as a service would never work if ScotRail continues to be as bad as it is. So just add more credence to what we're talking about.